listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We welcome all opinions, you know, except conspiracy theories.
That was Arianna Huffington, the co-founder and former editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, speaking at a forum at the Republican National Convention in 2008.
If you go backstage to the Huffington Post, if you have a password as a blogger, you see our guidelines. And if you believe that 9/11 was caused by the government, then we're not going to accept your blog post because we believe that facts are sacred. That's part of our philosophy of journalism that we are bringing to new media.
By the following year, Huffington was number 12 in Forbes' first ever list of the most influential women in media. 2 years later, the Huffington Post was sold to AOL for $315 million. AOL made Huffington president and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Media Group, which included the Huffington Post and other AOL properties. In August of 2016, it was announced that she would step down from her role at the Huffington Post to devote her time to a new startup focused on health and wellness information. Meanwhile, it appears that with her departure, the Huffington Post no longer concerns itself with facts. That, according to journalist Joe Loria, who arrived at that opinion based on his personal experience with Huffington Post over the past week. We spoke with him from Cairo via Skype and telephone Monday. So, Joe, I saw this piece at Consortium News, I think it was last week, about a week ago, The Democratic Money Behind Russiagate. And it goes through, you know, some of the things that have come out over the last 2 weeks or so in some considerable depth. And then I saw a discussion on Facebook about a piece that you wrote that you published at Huffington Post and apparently got scrapped. And we just heard a moment ago Arianna Huffington talking 9 years ago about the rules that they use. They don't allow you to have your own facts, but your piece seems loaded with facts. So let's talk about it.
Well, it is. Thank you for saying that. I wrote the piece originally for Consortium News. Bob Perry, the editor, edited it, and he gave it the headline, The Democratic Money Behind Russiagate. And you're right, I took the latest developments, and what my article is saying is that there were two main sources for the allegations that Russia influenced the election. And the first, it was CrowdStrike, the analyzer of DNC computers, and the second was the dossier from Christopher Steele, the former MI6 agent. What we learned first was that CrowdStrike was called in by the DNC because they wouldn't let the FBI suspiciously examine their server, their computer server, to see if it was indeed hacked at all. And then they brought in this company called CrowdStrike that is co-founded by Dmitry Alperovich, who is a anti-Putin Russian, who is also a fellow at the very anti-Russian Atlantic Council. Mm. And the CrowdStrike said that their evidence was that in one day they came up with this. They said that the evidence was Cyrillic letters and the fact that they named the first Soviet intelligence agent chief in this. They found this in the metadata. Well, I mean, and they said it was a sophisticated operation by a government. If it were a sophisticated operation, clearly they wouldn't leave those kinds of clues. Yeah, and then we learned later from Voice of America, of all people, they wrote a piece saying that the same software that CrowdStrike used to supposedly discover Russia had hacked the DNC, they used to say that Russia had hacked howitzers on the battlefield in eastern Ukraine. And both the Ukrainian army and the British council, a British think tank, both denied this. So the next day, CrowdStrike rewrote that software, admitted that it was a faulty software. The second source, of course, is the Steele memos themselves. And I talked about the fact that the Steele memos were not an intelligence document, even though he's a longtime intelligence agent for the MI6, the Foreign Intelligence Agency of Britain. He was the head of the Russia desk for them. But he was working not on a government salary, supposedly serving all of society as an intelligence agent, and his reports being verified and subject to being vetted by his own agency and other agencies, he was doing opposition research, which is a totally different thing.
Right.
He's being paid per piece, so he's motivated perhaps by money. He may have been motivated politically because Britain was anti-Trump even and accused Trump of colluding with Russia even before the Democrats did. Mm. And these memos were not seen as credible even by corporate media. We should give them credit, which is rare, because they didn't run with the stories even when the Clinton campaign was shopping it around throughout the summer of 2016 and the fall.
Yeah, we're talking they here about that. Right.
They saw this as opposition research, which is dirt for a political campaign. Who's working for a political candidate, not for government anymore? And the really big bombshell was the Washington Post mainstream source, if there ever was one, that said that the Clinton campaign paid for and the DNC paid for Steele with the intention, the New York Times reported, to link Trump to Russia,
right?
Which goes all the way back to the Cold War. Well, of course, even Bush, even Hillary Clinton's husband, if you remember, George H.W. Bush, tried to condemn Bill Clinton during the campaign because he spent a week as a student on vacation in Moscow during the Cold War. That. So this is a time-honored Cold War tactic and political campaign. Since we're in a new Cold War, it makes sense it was revived. So the whole idea was to link Trump to Russia from the beginning, and both the CrowdStrike and the DNC, and the Steele memos were paid for by the DNC, and the Steele memos also by the Clinton campaign. So they were behind both of these. This is what I'm basically arguing. And then I also, in the piece, talk about the consequences of this campaign, and that was a new McCarthyism, where anybody who questions this story or any kind of thing about attacks on Russia is immediately labeled a Putin stooge or a dupe or a useful idiot. And we knew about the Washington Post publishing that piece at the end of last year, in which they listed people, listed publications that they claimed from an anonymous source were Russian agents. And then a new list came out a couple of weeks ago by an outfit called European Values. Mm. The writer has also worked for the Atlantic Council. Right. And she has a list of 2,000 or more individuals, including David Ignatius, one of the most CIA-friendly columnists there is, and David Stock, who was the head of the opposition research for Clinton, and Secretary General Antonio Guterres, all these are considered useful idiots for Russia because they've appeared on RT. Yep. This is the kind of nonsense that has come out of this Russia, these Russia allegations, which have no hard evidence yet. That's the point I'm making. When it appears, I will believe it. I will accept it. But I think being a skeptic is the right thing to do, especially now that we know that the two main sources for this were the Steele memos and the CrowdStrike probe of the computer. And also, I in the update for the Huffington Post, I included testimony from Comey and Clapper in which they both said, alluded to the fact that the Steele memos formed the basis for the January 6th assessment. Now, this is key because that was the real, you know, the three agencies handpicked analysts who said that Russia had hacked the computers and had used their influence operations to change this election for Trump. And we know now that the Democrats paid for both of those, and there's no hard evidence, and that's why there was no hard evidence in the January 6th dossier of the three intelligence agencies, because they must have realized this was a very dodgy dossier, and they have said, and Clapper said on the record in that brief, in that testimony, that they have not verified what he wrote. So it's a piece of opposition research. Now, I published the updated version with this these things I'm saying about Clapper and Comey for the Huffington Post. I also included the stories of the Manafort and Papadopoulos indictments because they happened after the consortium piece came out. And basically, I'm saying that the only campaign that received dirt on the opponent was the Clinton campaign because they actually paid for it, whereas the Trump campaign was twice offered it by a British entertainment promoter and then by this professor in the Papadopoulos indictment. And in either case, we know, as has been proven, that any dirt was ever turned over. So, and it's not illegal to get opposition research from a foreign source. From a foreign individual or government, that's not illegal. If it were, the Clinton campaign would have broken the law. And finally, in the article, I talk about the dangers that this whole story brings in terms of a possible confrontation between Russia and the United States and what that implies in terms of the weapons both sides have, and that the United States has been trying to get back to a Yeltsin figure in Russia because it was in those days that they controlled and dominated Russia with alliances with oligarchs and what Yeltsin to asset strip the whole country, impoverish the people in a rich Western capital. And also, the fact is that the U.S. helped Yeltsin get reelected. This was published in Time magazine. Everybody knows this.
Front page.
So this is what happened.
It was on the front cover of Time magazine. And they announced it, basically.
So that's an overview of the articles. Now, what happened was I posted it myself on the Huffington Post because I am a contributor. I've been contributing to the Huffington Post for about 10 years at least. And their system now is that you can post your own articles directly to the site. That's the way it actually used to be in the beginning. So I posted it under the new headline of On the Origins of Russiagate. And it was up there for 23 hours when I learned it was pulled down. I was never contacted by anyone from the Huffington Post. And that's a violation, in my opinion, of a newsroom rule, which is before you retract a piece, you contact the writer. And it's called due process. They never gave me a chance. They never gave me a chance to defend what I'd written, even though the article is full of links. And I have more corroborating evidence that I could produce if they'd asked me. Right. And they never said a word to me. They just pulled it. And I only learned, why they pulled it, because they issued a statement, not to me, but to Peter Perlberg, who is the BuzzFeed media reporter. He contacted the Huffington Post, asked why they'd pulled my piece, and they issued a statement. And the statement says that it was posted by me, self-published by me, by Mr. Loria, and was flagged by readers. And after deciding that the post contained multiple, factually inaccurate or misleading claims, our editors removed the post per our contributed terms of use. Now, what was that Arianna Huffington told you?
Yeah, that no one's entitled to their own facts. That's what she said.
But only conspiracy theories they won't allow.
That's right.
Do they think they did not accuse me of a conspiracy theory in this statement?
Right.
There are plenty of, it's a factually based analysis. I can understand why a Democratic site like, establishment Democratic site like the Huffington Post would not agree with my analysis or my interpretation of the facts. But to accuse me without contacted me and given me a chance to defend myself, that there is factual inaccuracies in this story. I don't, of course, don't believe there are, but I want to hear what they have to say.
Yeah, you would think that there would be an item.
I'm contacting them now to find out, and I do not believe they will answer me.
You know,
I'm going to contact them and ask them what were the factual inaccuracies.
Yeah, you would think you'd be entitled to a detail. You know, here are the factual inaccuracies. And then, you know, perhaps give you an opportunity to say, oh, well, I said that this happened. They claim that it didn't. Here's a photograph of it happening. You know, you have an opportunity to try the facts, basically. And that step was skipped over entirely. You know, it's troubling on so many levels. You know, you mentioned the fact that you have... you know, maybe World War III looming in the background as a consequence of this whole Russiagate thing. And also, you know, that what this means for journalism, this kind of treatment, you know, with the Huffington Post, for, if nothing else, is pretty widely read, you know, all things considered, for new media. And, you know, with this kind of, you know, lack of process and the lack of concern over facts is troubling. But there's another thing, too, inside of this, where you have... the DNC paying for this oppositional research that is then used as the basis for FISA wiretaps against the Trump
yes.
campaign. And now, you had at the time that you had this going on, you have a president who's, you know, Democratic Party president, like Hillary Clinton, came out in an unprecedented, you know, manner to support her, promised people abroad that Trump would not be elected, you know, said publicly to leaders in Europe that this wouldn't happen, sits on top of the intelligence agencies that are conducting FISA warrant wiretaps on the leading people in the campaign based on, you know, induced by this quote-unquote evidence that was paid for by the Democratic National Committee. I mean, if you compare that scenario to what Nixon was driven out of office over, Nixon looks like an amateur.
Yeah, it's really horrendous. And also, you remember Obama left clues everywhere in all the agencies so they can pick this up.
Yep.
When Trump took over. No, I mean, it looks very, very bad right now. I think there's a very good chance that the Mueller investigation will find some financial crimes like the ones that he's charged Manafort with. It could even engulf Trump in this. He may be tied up with some gangsters. I don't think they will prove, because so far we've seen no evidence, that Russia hacked the emails and that Russia in any way really contributed to Trump's election.
But when you confront this kind of zealotry, this kind of quasi-religious faith, then you're faced with what I think I was just faced with at the Huffington Post, which is they don't want to hear it, they cannot hear it, they're impervious to reason or facts that they don't, that are inconvenient for them to have to hear. And I think this is what's at the basis, although I don't know, but I suspect the Huffington Post will not respond to my requests for the reasons why they pulled the piece, why they feel certain parts were inaccurate. I want to know what they were. I want a chance to defend myself. They're not going to put the piece back up, but I have a right to know the reasons why they pulled it and what the wrong facts supposedly are. And I don't anticipate that. So I just think they don't want to hear them. They're shutting it out.
Yeah. You know, not for nothing. If it were true that Russia hacked the election, quote unquote, or swung the election with $100,000, I'd want to have them do my media buy. Whenever, you know, I want to sell Buicks or whatever, I'm hiring Russia. Take my ad campaign, because that's really a lot of bang for your buck as opposed to $2 billion, which is what people estimate,
you know,
Clinton spent, you know, between her and the, you know, the private money, the, you know, hidden money.
There's another thing that I included in the update in the Huffington Post from the Steele memo, in which he quotes Source E, which he says is an ethnic Russian close to Donald Trump, telling him that he knows that Russia hacked the DNC computer. Now, one thing, if it was a Russian intelligence operation to hack the DNC computer, it would be on a need-to-know basis. And why would anyone from the Trump campaign need to know that, so that they may talk? There would be no need to have involvement of Trump campaign officials in a hack, which is remote, most likely from outside the United States.
It
doesn't make any sense. The only thing they are alleging is that these emails were offered to Papadopoulos, this low-level foreign, George Papadopoulos' low-level Trump foreign policy advisor, but they were never produced. Just like the dirt that was supposedly going to go to Don Jr. was never produced. In that meeting with the lawyer, the one that everyone, like Rachel Maddow and the others, foaming at the mouth to say was smoking gun. But there's no evidence that any dirt was turned over. And even if it had been, it's not illegal. And the fact is that Hillary Clinton's campaign did get dirt from Russia through Christopher Steele.
Right.
So, I mean, you know,
yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
You know, so we're talking about two things here. One is the hacking of the DNC computers. And that, everybody's accusing, Trump of doing it, saying that they can get them because that's a crime. Hacking somebody else's computer,
right,
taking the information, and publicly distributing it is a crime. And if it happened across national or even state borders, federal jurisdiction, FBI. DNC did not turn the computers over to the FBI. Instead, they hired somebody to look at it and do the quote-unquote forensics. That's the first thing. So there's no objective party, even if you're going to say the FBI is objective, but not even a nominally objective party that's producing the evidence for this. No one's done, the FBI has not done the forensics on those computers. And then, as you mentioned, you have Cyrillic alphabets, basically left on the scene, like somebody had cut out from a Russian magazine some letters and, left them at the crime scene,
exactly.
And not for nothing again, Ukrainian also uses that same exact alphabet, more or less. There are a couple of letters that are different, but it's a Cyrillic alphabet. And so the fact that there's a Cyrillic alphabet there doesn't even tell you which side of the Russia, anti-Russia, chasm these people fall down on. And as a matter of fact, if you're looking at the politics, it's quite possible that someone from Ukraine could be doing this because of their fight with Russia and further because of Manafort's connection to Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought up Ukraine. It's just, there's a lot being made of the fact that at the Republican convention, the platform plank was changed to no longer call for the provision of lethal weapons to the Ukrainian government to fight people in eastern Ukraine who are defending their democracy because the guy they elected was overthrown in a coup that the U.S. helped. And that was Obama's position as well, not to send lethal weapons.
Right.
So it was not a radical move on the Republicans' part, but they're trying to say there's a quid pro quo there, that they would give dirt on Clinton or that they had some financial or other blackmailable material on Trump that they would withhold if the Republicans promised not to provide lethal weapons to Ukraine. But again, that was Obama's position. That is not that is not proof of any kind of bribery, in my opinion. But we'll see what Mueller comes up with. But the only crimes really are, aside from any financial crimes, the hacking of the computer. That's correct.
Yep.
Nothing else is a crime here. You could collude all you want, as long as you're not colluding to commit a crime.
Right.
Collusion is not a crime by itself.
Right. And, that
doesn't seem to matter to the mainstream press.
That's right. There is no statutory prohibition against, quote-unquote, collusion. And
correct.
You mentioned before also, if there were the intent, say, in the Russian government to help Trump win, and if they stole the DNC materials or got their hands on them through whatever method, it is not at all necessary to tell Trump other than letting him read about it in the New York Times when it's released, which is as much coordination as you would need, and now you don't have any fingerprints all over it. Someone that you would think is smart enough to do the hacking, to win an election with $100,000, all of that, probably could figure that out and also figure out there's no point in having someone pull something from a platform of a political campaign because they have nothing to do with the policy that will be implemented when that person takes office.
Exactly. That's really chicken feed stuff there.
Yeah.
A platform at a convention, really.
Please.
We could see how they let Bernie's people go in there. And even then they fought them.
Right.
But that was the bone that they threw to Bernie to support her, that he would have an input on the. Who cares about platforms?
Nobody.
I mean, nobody. Once the election's over, the platform is totally forgotten. Nobody's sitting around reading a platform to say, did they implement what they said they were going to? No.
Right. And, you know,
no, it doesn't work like that.
If it did work like that, we would be living in a world full of peace and milk and honey, because they've been promised for generations in those platforms.
Yeah. I want to give a shout out to Ray McGovern, because he took up my calls on his blog, raymcgovern.com. Mm. It's gotten almost 1,400 hits, this piece. And he has a link there that his son was able to make from the PDF that I saved from the original Huffington Post article, the one that was pulled. I made a PDF of it, and wow. Ray's son put it online so it could be read. If you go to raymcgovern.com, it's the top story. It's the top story right now in his blog, and there's a link to the actual story that no longer exists, and I believe it was censorship because it was for political reasons that this was pulled. And it's interesting that Huffington Post statement says that readers complained. I would love to know who those readers were. If there was anyone in the Democratic establishment or whoever it was, they took total precedence over a writer of theirs who wasn't even contacted to be asked to defend what I'd written, which I'm absolutely prepared to do. And it's already defended in the article itself with all many, many links that I have.
So, and you've been writing about this stuff for a while, and it appears in a number of platforms, aside from Consortium News and Huffington Post. Some of the other places that people can find your work, why don't you maybe point our listeners to that?
Well, those are the two main places right now. I'd written for, my Consortium News stories. I picked up sometimes by Global Research, by
right.
Common Dreams,
right.
By various blogs. I once wrote 6 years for the Wall Street Journal, which may be coming to surprise some
mm-hmm.
people.
Nope.
So I have a long, long background in corporate media, and I'm not a partisan because I dislike intensely both parties.
Yeah.
And there is no party, in my opinion,
right. yeah.
that represents me and my interests and the interests of millions of Americans. It doesn't exist.
Right.
So I'm free to step outside of this partisan debate because I don't like either one of them. And certainly don't defend Donald Trump in any way and did not support him, and I can't stand him. But I'm a reporter, and I look for the facts. And this is what's so ironic about this. They're saying the facts are wrong. If you follow the facts logically and you're not blinded by a partisan position, then you will come to the conclusion. Now, it's true Fox News sometimes get some things right on this Russia thing, but they're motivated for partisan reasons, and I don't
right.
agree with that
right.
at all. And I don't feel any affinity for right-wingers who sometimes like some things that I write about Hillary Clinton, including the book that I did based on her, on those WikiLeaks emails called How I Lost to Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
So, and, Julian Assange wrote the foreword, and that is like, if they see that, the Democrats are going crazy. So, they hate his guts. And
we spoke about that book, a while back, and after it came out. And I'm wondering, because your book, How I Lost by Hillary Clinton, came out before hers. Have you considered an
yes.
action for a copyright violation?
No. No, but in fact, republishing those emails, what is a shaky thing to do, because
right.
she still owns the copyright on the emails. We
yeah.
They are stolen.
Yeah.
But under the First Amendment, you're allowed to publish even if you didn't do the stealing. The stealing is the crime.
Right.
Not the publishing, at least
right.
up until now.
Right.
But we hear Pompeo and others in the Trump administration will really seriously maybe want to go after journalists this time. It's been talked about since Nixon and before
yeah.
that journalists should be prosecuted, too, for publishing it. Maybe they always stop short because of the First Amendment, and I'm hoping yeah. that's going to happen again.
Well, the New York Times, it chilled
yeah.
the New York Times when Ellsberg and all of them came with the Pentagon Papers. It took a while to get that stuff out, and even reading it into the congressional record.
Well, I wrote a book on Mike Gravel, who's the senator.
Right.
Gravel.
That's right. He did.
Read
yep.
it into
that's
the
right.
congressional
yep.
record.
Yep.
And I wrote from his point of view, the entire Pentagon Papers story, and Dan Ellsberg wrote the forward for our book. For that. So, yes, that was a really solid case, but it could happen that they will go after journalists, in some way. And this is the reason why still Julian Assange is remaining in the embassy in London.
Yeah, with Julian Assange.
I have to say, Don, I've been out of the country a while now. I'm talking to you from Cairo. And what I, from seeing from abroad, it's really scary what's going on, let alone the almost normal normalization now of mass shootings, which is in itself just so horrendous. And the reaction to it is even scarier to me, that it's just sort of being accepted somehow.
Right.
But the political situation now, what I just experienced with this, what I really believe is censorship, the absolute madness of both sides in the political debate now. I've not seen anything like it since the Vietnam War. I was in my teens. But I think that was a real debate about a war. This, I don't understand this at all. Can you enlighten me? What the situation is there?
If I could understand it, I would. It's the same. There's some of somewhat of an apparent schism between, say, the entire U.S. media on the one hand, except for Fox, and Fox on the other, where it seems like everyone at CNN, CBS, Democracy Now, wherever, wakes up in the morning and says, "Okay, we're going to tell everybody that this is why Trump, stinks today." And that's going to be the focus of all of their news coverage. And Fox will say this is why they're good. But it comes down to, for example, Trump is no good because he's a Russia dupe. And Fox saying, no, Clinton is a Russia dupe. And that's the break in it. But looming right behind that is an assumption that Russia is the enemy and somebody's a dupe and we got to do something about it. And so that's kind of what's going on here. I don't know how to summarize it more than that.
I just saw a headline that Carter Page wanted to set up a meeting, a speech by candidate Trump in Russia. Now, if he was going to talk about detente, I think that would be wonderful.
Absolutely true.
But
yep.
Well, why is this any meeting that was held with a Russian? Now, I'm in contact with Russians every day. So I better tell the FBI the truth if they ask me. Otherwise, they're going to get me for lying, right? This is basically what they got Papadopoulos on.
Right.
And now, so there's a meeting with a Russian. So what? The meeting itself is not a story. You see, this is where we've gotten with the corporate coverage of this whole thing. That if there's a meeting, that's become the big story. But what happened at that meeting? Was there some kind of criminal activity that went on? Is there a No, they just had a meeting. So that becomes a big story.
Let's go back to July of 2008. With fanfare typically orchestrated for a visiting head of state, Senator Barack Obama dashed through a series of meetings with the Israeli and Palestinian leaders.
There you go.
Okay, but we're out of time. Thanks, Joe.
Okay, a little bit.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. In terms of foreign policy, Donald Trump has already earned himself the title the Low Expectations President. This title is now being put to the test during his tour of Asia. Is the U.S. a status quo power in the Asia-Pacific region or merely a foil challenging China? Cross-talking Trump's visit to Asia, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Maloof in Washington. He is a former senior security policy analyst in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. In Lake Jackson, we have Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. And in Brussels, we have Gilbert Doctorow. He is the European coordinator of the American Committee for East-West Accord. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Daniel, let me go to you. As President Trump was going to Asia, his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, said that the objective is to rally allies to achieve, quote, complete, verifiable, and permanent denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Is that hyperbole? I mean, are they really serious? I mean, we have a lot of bluster coming out. Then we have some contradictions in tweets. I'd like to meet the man. I mean, what is the focus here? I mean, it seems, as usual, I'm sorry, all over the place. Daniel.
I mean, if that is the benchmark for success, then he's just set his boss up for failure, because President Trump will not come home with a deal like that in his pocket. And I think that's one of the reasons we saw early on this week, when the president started talking about Korea, he seems to have softened the rhetoric, no more fire and fury. He now sounds like, let's make a deal. As you pointed out, I wouldn't mind sitting down with the man. So I think that might be an attempt to lower expectations. But as you also say, he is all over the place. So could be something very different tomorrow.
You know, Michael, you know, weigh in on that, because I get the feeling you're saying to us all, this is the strategy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it is. I think Trump came off with all this bluster, and I think when you look at, as I said before, that chapter two of Art of the Deal is the elements of the deal. Leverage is what he's keying in on. This is what he experienced in his real estate days. That is his base from which all else springs eternal in terms of his work and experience. Bluster and then leveraging and to try and come up with the best options. That's why you hear him talk one day, fire and fury, and on the next day, let's sit down and have hamburger diplomacy, in effect, because last year he said he could sit down and have a hamburger with Kim Jong-un, and he did it again earlier this year. Now, I think, but what I think is happening here is that there's a lot more going on behind the scenes for discussions. Now, to address the one point that was made, I don't expect an agreement as such right now. What I do expect is a laying of a foundation for discussions, mm-hmm. for future discussions, because the ultimate goal is to denuclearize. It's not going to happen at the get-go, but it can happen as we move along. And I think what they need to be doing is and have Trump make another bombastic offer, challenge him to open diplomacy by maybe offering him full diplomatic relations. But, do you turn that down?
Okay, there is a diplomatic ploy out there. We'll get to it later in the program. It's called the Russian-Chinese deal. I want to get into that in a second. Gilbert, hamburger diplomacy. You know, if it's about building the wall or taxes or, you know, all these other esoteric things that are going on inside the United States, I get it, okay? But I don't think the Chinese and the Japanese and the South Koreans and the Russians get it, okay? You have a very strong military power in the Pacific, and it's unclear what that power's position is. I think that is a very dangerous, precarious situation for the entire region to address. Gilbert in Brussels, please.
All right. I'm not a specialist on East Asia, but I'm sitting in Brussels, and I do confer with local politicians and people who are considering how to change Belgian and possibly European foreign policy. And I can tell you right now that they are very, very perturbed. They are confused by Donald Trump, by his actions. And at the same time, as I observe that, I would like to answer the question that you've held out for the very end, which is he performing above or below expectations? From my perspective, he's performing above expectations.
Okay.
But my expectations changed. I had no idea that he could be so successful in making progress on destruction of American global hegemony by just being Donald. I didn't foresee that.
That is such an interesting point, and that's a topic for another program. And I think that's a fascinating point to make here. Okay,
Peter,
that's the point of the program. Michael in Washington, jump in.
Look, all that Trump is trying to do, out of all of this chaos, there is an order that's emerging here. What Trump is trying to do, unlike the Obama administration for 8 years, is establish control the situation, and everyone else will follow. We used to be reactive. Now he wants to take control, and you'll notice how everybody, as a result of his bombacity toward North Korea, has begun to come in and focus in on what he wants.
Well, Michael,
to do,
you can turn it completely upside down, I think, okay? I think, you know, in the mainstream media, they're saying, you know, but it's China has to do China. You know what? If if China has to do something and China has to be the key to this, China will decide what the outcome is. And Trump is by
they
his
can't.
By
it,
his it, no yes by Trump's behavior and his words and his advisors all over the place. The Chinese know. Let me go to Daniel here. I think the Chinese know that at the end of the day they will get the deal they want because they don't like the situation in the North as well. Go ahead, Daniel.
That's true.
Well, this is ultimately a problem for China and for Russia much more than
right.
the U.S., despite
the
scare tactics of warning us that there are nuclear missiles that are headed for us, there are WMDs in Baghdad, et cetera, et cetera. This is a Chinese and Russian problem, and it has a lot more to do with trade and with regional security than with global security. But let's not forget one thing. Why are the North Koreans pursuing a nuclear weapon? Why do they have one? Some say they may have one, some say they don't. Despite what we may think of the North Korean government, it is a very rational response to an unstable part of the world.
Exactly.
Why is it unstable? Because the U.S. still believes that it has the right to hegemony in East Asia, that the South China Sea somehow is actually the South America China Sea or something of that nature. So it is a rational response. You can't force them to act irrationally against their own self-interest. You have to change the situation to enable a rational action to be something that's more in line with what Washington may want.
Okay, I agree with you completely.
The problem is...
Gilbert, jump in Brussels.
The problem is, Peter, yeah, the commonality of Donald Trump's behavior wherever he is. And that is a problem for his achieving any of the objectives that his assistants set out. And I have in mind here the bullying, the insulting behavior directly. There's been remarkably little press coverage of Donald Trump's visit to Asia.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot of press coverage in Japan. But here in Europe and the United States, which I follow in online editions, I see almost nothing. The trip has been taken over, the space on the front page has been taken over by the shootings in Texas. By the latest possibilities for Mueller to move on Flynn. By a lot of fake and phony news. And if you find a little paragraph on page one that Trump is here or there, that's a lot. Now, that is very unusual for a visit of this importance and this duration by an American president
I think it's very telling, Gilbert. I think you're absolutely right because they don't want to see any success on that trip at all. It's built in for them. I mean, again, you know, the Americans' self-interest, you know, people are so selfish in the United States and the political class. We're talking about global security. Okay, and I would like to see Donald Trump succeed. I just don't see the elements. I don't see the elements being put together in the right way for that to happen here. You know, Michael, let me go back to you. You know, the Chinese and the Russians have a diplomatic gambit out there. When there was sanctions voted in the Security Council, if you listen to the Russians, you listen to the Chinese, they gave a roadmap. I know nobody in the New York Times and CNN has that. They don't have the attention span to listen to an entire speech from a foreigner, okay? But it's all laid out right there. Why can't the United States embrace it? Freeze for freeze. I think our audience knows what I'm talking about. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I think it's coming around to that. At first, it wasn't. And I would agree that the Russians and the Chinese have tremendous stakes involved in all of this, and only because of their proximity for one, and also because of the leverage that they can exert. But at the same time, the United States is a world power. It is there. It's not going to go anywhere. And it has a defense treaty with South Korea. It's not going to go anywhere. And that's why China still needs North Korea. And I think China is walking a very tight rope because it cannot do so much what the United States wants without throwing that country into total chaos and thereby creating the very chaos that it is trying to avoid. And that's what's going to put that is what would back Kim Jong-un's into the corner and cause him to lash out. And I think that's what they're trying to avoid.
That's the North Koreans' ace up their sleeve, because they know that the United States conducts its policy in the region with only American interests in mind. They do not think seriously about the interests of others. I mean, look. You know, Trump saying he's going to destroy North Korea, and then South Koreans say, hey, maybe you should ask us about that first, okay? I mean, it's this extraordinary. Gentlemen, I'm going to go to a short break here. After that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's visit to Asia. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Daniel and Lake Jackson here. One of the best things that Trump did when he became president is to pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Absolutely was necessary. But what is Trump proposing in place of it? Because he doesn't like multilateral things. Okay, and if it is multilateral, the U.S. has to control it. Okay, it's a fig leaf. Okay, but in this case, it's bilateral right now. Does the U.S. have really the stamina and the strength to be making new deals? Because, I mean, the United States is the biggest debtor country in the world. I mean, what kind of leverage do the Chinese, the South Koreans, the Japanese, Vietnamese even have with the United States right now? The U.S. only has its military. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, you can't make new deals with old ideas. And while I agree with you that pulling out of the TPP was a very good idea, certainly from a free trade perspective, because these large trade deals really are sweetheart deals for crony capitalists and well-connected companies. They don't benefit across the board. But what is he replacing it with? We've seen already twice on this trip to Asia, President Trump saying the Japanese are going to buy a lot more of our weapons. Oh, the South Koreans are going to buy a lot more of our weapons. So I'm wondering, is this the leader of the free world or the global sales rep for the military industrial complex? You know, that's what I wonder when I see him overseas. He told the Japanese this trip is about making jobs back in the U.S. I don't think he understands what it takes to make jobs back in the U.S. Certainly strong arming the Chinese to buy more of our things will not achieve the goals. The problems for U.S. trade are located back here in the U.S., in Asia.
I mean, Daniel, how can you have industrial jobs if you don't have a plant? I mean, they're gone. They're empty. They're shells all across the country. Okay. Again, I can't fathom this here. Gilbert, let me change gears here. One of the things that's really quite interesting, I saw an interview with the Japanese prime minister, and our viewers may or may not know, but there's a very heated debate going on in Japan about its pacifist constitution. And listening to Abe when he was speaking with Fox News, I got a bit of a sense that, you know, the Japanese are basically saying to the United States is that we can defend ourselves if necessary, and we really don't need your arms, okay? I mean, there needs to be a legal change, and it seems to have traction in Japan. And then the Japanese, again, 75 years after the fact, become a military power in Asia. Of course, not a lot of people in Asia would like that, but it might suit Japan's interests quite well. Because if you see indecision in the White House, why wait around when you can do it yourself? Go ahead. Gilbert.
Yeah, we have a similar issue here in Europe, so I'm a bit prepared in handling this. I don't believe we're going to see new institutions. I don't believe we're going to see a sea change in terms of how these countries defend themselves. But the question that arises, will there be greater willingness on the part of the Japanese behind closed doors, as there can be among the Europeans behind closed doors, to push back? Generally speaking, the relationship between the United States and its allies has been one of a suzerain and vassals. And the vassals have, among themselves, agreed always to do and say whatever the United States tells them to say. How long this will go on is under question now. Because of the unpredictability of Trump and the American foreign policy, I think there are many of our allies who are smiling to the television cameras and smiling to the reporters and saying all the nice sounds, but are thinking among themselves how to reassure themselves, not by breaking up institutions or overturning the world order, but by pushing back within the existing institutions to defend their interests more.
You know, Michael, I was very disappointed when President Trump's, well, it was during a public appearance, and I think he chimed in when the Japanese prime minister was talking, and he said, and we're going to sell you more weapons. I found that to be disappointing because the future of that region is the future of the world. You look at the countries, I mean, their middle classes are expanding amazingly so. I mean, people, a generation ago, people that were in poverty now have an iPhone. It's extraordinary what's going on there. And the country that has the sway in the region is China. People look to China. China is more interested in trade and making money. And that is very attractive. Mm-hmm. I may be wrong, but I don't see China trying to export its values and its institutions. They're saying, we want to make money. You want to make money with us? I would like to see the president of the United States make the same message and take that to his Asian interlocutors. I don't see it happening. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I think that you've covered a lot of area there in your comments. China does indeed spread its own gospel, if you will, when it goes into Asia, goes into Africa, goes into Latin America. It's trying to assert its own influence in those regions. What the United States is attempting to do, and it's been doing for since the end of World War II, is to keep Japan from rearming, number one, and South Korea and Japan from developing nuclear weapons. When I was at the Pentagon, we worked very hard to keep South Korea from developing its own nuclear weapons program, as well as Japan. They threatened to do that on numerous occasions if something wasn't done about North Korea. So for that pledge for the United States to maintain its security umbrella over those countries, they agreed that they would not pursue. Now, with Trump being there, he has agreed to allow for the extension of their ballistic missiles in South Korea. That never would have happened 5 to 10 years ago. And frankly, Japan and South Korea rely very heavily on military hardware for their defense. They have our military planes.
They pay a lot of money for it. They pay an enormous amount of money for it.
Yeah,
I mean, you just said the conditions. Let me go to Daniel. Why don't the Japanese, the South Koreans, what their defense interests are instead of Washington doing it? That's the problem here. You want to finish up, Michael? Go ahead.
Yeah. One other thing. I think one of the considerations is that we don't want Japan to arm itself because of the concerns that China might have as a result of their experiences of World War II.
And South Korea. Okay, Daniel, let me see.
So it's better for the United States to give them the arms rather than have them develop their own indigenous industries.
So, I mean, just keep pumping in the arms. What could possibly go wrong, okay? Daniel, let me go to you.
They want them.
Let me go to you, Daniel. So we had with NATO, keep the Germans down, the Americans in, and the Russians out. So now in Asia, it's keep the Americans in, the Japanese and South Koreans down, and the Chinese out. Do you like that? Does that work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of one of these is not like the other. You know, the U.S. is the odd man out in the region. And I think we're seeing some interesting developments in places like South Korea. Look at Moon Jae-in, who was recently elected on a platform of returning to a degree to the Sunshine Policy of better relations with North Korea. I think if the U.S. were to just leave the two Koreas alone,
agreed,
to step out and pull back, you would see a natural progression. The media didn't report very much, but there was a fairly large demonstration in South Korea this week where people were saying our anxiety is very high, we don't like the rhetoric coming out of Washington or North Korea, this needs to ratchet down. The South Korean people have spoken and they would look to rapprochement with North Korea. If the U.S. would step back and let it happen, we would find some of these problems going away very easily, I think.
You know, gentlemen, I think we've got something out of...
Okay, Michael, you want to jump in real quick? Go ahead.
Yeah, so why does South Korea still continue to allow for military exercises with the United States, which aggravates and antagonizes North Korea, if that is their intention? They're not doing it. That needs to stop.
It's because
if we're really going to have a rapprochement,
come back to China for a moment.
Yeah. No, Okay, that's just I'm sorry, Michael.
That's true. That's a good point, but it's because they're under enormous pressure.
That's moral hazard as well. That's moral hazard. It puts you in a position where you don't have to take care of yourself. That is irresponsible. Go ahead, Gilbert and Brussels. Go ahead,
Peter. Yeah, I'd like to deal with one other issue around China, because China has been in newspaper coverage and Financial Times and elsewhere in the last couple of days with remarks that Xi is seeking an acknowledgement of equality with the United States as a world power. Now, this takes us back a bit. I can see this coming from within the State Department promoting that notion, because the notion was promoted under Obama. People spoke about a G2. Well, there never was a G2. There isn't one today. And so I think it will be with this issue of Xi pushing back. I think that's a figment of imagination within the American foreign policy community and not a reality in China at the time. China is buying time. China is waiting for the time when it will supersede the United States as the world's largest economy and possibly also as the world's largest military. And then they'll turn around and talk seriously. I can't imagine Xi trying to engage in hand wrestling with Trump over equality and becoming the equal partner. I can't imagine the United States, even if Trump would agree, that he would come home to Congress, he would be burned on that one as well.
No, yeah, but
American foreign policy.
Exactly, but I mean, but actually, rationally speaking, that wouldn't be a bad idea. Daniel, but this, I'm glad we're gonna end on this point here, because it's just a worldview. For the United States, the unipolar moment will never end, but the reality on the ground tells us completely different, that the unipolar moment is crumbling. It's like sand going through your hands. And it's a traumatic feeling for the foreign policy establishment. And, you know, it's not the, we don't have to worry about a rising China, but it's a declining U.S. with its military. Go ahead, 40 seconds. Daniel, last word.
One of my favorite modern thinkers is Nicholas Nassim Taleb, and he talks about fragility and anti-fragility. U.S. foreign policy is extremely fragile. Any change in the world system, because it is not flexible and it disintegrates. The U.S. has military in 53 out of 54 countries in Africa. The Chinese are also there, but they're not there with their military. They are there doing business and making deals. That's an anti-fragile approach to the world. The U.S. fragile approach to foreign policy is doomed to fail unless there's some new thinking.
Okay, you ended on perfectly onto the second here. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, Brussels, and in Lake Jackson. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.